Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
I'm optimistic that you'll see our vaccine be deployed and help prevent COVID-19 in many people.
A second vaccine trial for COVID-19 showing signs of success and more light at the end of the tunnel. As research continues, I ask senior medical correspondent Elizabeth Cohen about this milestone. And I speak to vaccine trial volunteer R. Walter Isaacson about his experience and why he did it. Then,
change has come to Georgia.
The balance of power in the U.S. Senate now rests with the state of Georgia. I speak to Democratic nominee John Ossoff about this high-stakes race. Plus,
I think it's pretty clear that at least 500,000 Americans will die before the end of this pandemic.
As cases increase at a record speed, our Hari Srinivasan talks to Yale professor and physician Nicholas Christakis about his new book, Apollo's Arrow, and the impact of the coronavirus on all our lives.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. And it is the way we all want to start the week, with a bit of good news. Early data on a second promising coronavirus vaccine. The American company Moderna announced today that results so far are showing it to be 94.5% effective. And here's what its chief medical officer, Dr. Tal Zaks, says.
I am very happy that our vaccine has been able to demonstrate very strong immunogenicity across all age groups, so we don't lose potency. As we look at least at the phase one data, you see the same level of an immune response across both younger and older adults.
This just a week after Pfizer shared the successful early results of its own trials. And these are difficult times as infections increase at unprecedented speed in the United States, with now over 11 million cases and nearly 250,000 deaths, while Europe continues to see record numbers and the British Prime Minister self-isolates again after a meeting with an infected MP. You'll remember that he was hospitalized with COVID-19 back in April. Now, of course, the question on everyone's mind, when will life return to normal? My first guest tonight is senior medical correspondent Elizabeth Cohen, and she joins us from Atlanta, Georgia. And Elizabeth, that was obviously your interview with Moderna's chief medical officer. Just how exciting is this? It's the second now.
Oh, I think it's very exciting. I mean, Christiane, people were hoping, experts were hoping for a vaccine that was maybe 60% effective, 70 if we got lucky, 80 was like a pipe dream. But look what happened. We have two vaccines that are more than 90% effective and where they didn't see any serious side effects. I mean, people had headaches or body aches, but nothing really bad. That is really quite incredible.
And can you tell me, Elizabeth, explain how it works? We understand it's RNA-based. What exactly does that mean?
Right. So a lot of times we think of vaccines as you give someone a sort of a weakened version of the virus, and then you make it, and then your body launches an immune attack. And that's how your body learns, oh, OK, this is a foreign invader. Here's how to attack it. Instead, what this does is that this vaccine, and Pfizer's works the same way, Moderna and Pfizer are basically identical. It sends in a little piece of messenger RNA that is basically a blueprint, a recipe for making the spike that sits atop the coronavirus. If you ever see that picture, it's those little red flower-like things. So it tells, it gives instructions for making that spike. Your body sees the spike, it learns how to fight it. So then when you get the real virus, your antibodies will be ready. Now, Christiane, there's never been a vaccine on the market that uses this mRNA, this messenger RNA technology. So if this gets approved and or authorized, this will be a first.
It is amazing. I mean, we're really seeing it happening very, very fast now. I just want to ask you, you know, when Pfizer's came out, when the early results came out, there was a lot of talk about, you know, storage, how it had to be kept at a really, really low temperature. And that might have some issues, particularly in the hot parts of the world and the poor parts of the world. Tell me about this one. Does it require the same temperature?
It actually doesn't. This one only requires negative minus 20 degrees Celsius. And at least in the United States, and I'm sure in other parts of the world as well, there are freezers that go that low. You have one in your house. I have one in my house. It's just how you keep ice cream. So doctors' offices, pharmacists, they have this freezer already. They don't have to invent something new. Pfizer's is very different. Theirs is minus 75 degrees Celsius. Doctors' offices and pharmacies, again, at least in the U.S., do not have freezers that go that low. So you have to work with dry ice and do all this other kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. It gets very complicated, somewhat prone to error, according to state officials and doctors and nurses who I've talked to. So yes, there was definitely a sense of relief that this one doesn't have that kind of requirement.
And again, rollout, everybody also talks about how many millions, hundreds of millions of doses will have to be made. You perhaps need two shots. And obviously, Dr. Fauci is really involved with a lot of this. I think he worked along with Moderna on this. This is what he said to NBC about this issue.
We have two vaccines that are really quite effective. So I think this is a really strong step forward to where we want to be about getting control of this outbreak.
So control of this outbreak, that's what everybody wants to know about, especially given the news that we've just reported. It's just galloping along, this COVID. What about the rollout?
So the rollout, at least in the United States, is going to be over a period of at least 6 months. So Dr. Fauci, who I talked to last night, said he thinks that high-risk people, elderly people, healthcare workers, et cetera, could start getting vaccines in the second part of December. But he said it won't be until the end of April that people who are not in high-risk groups, in other words, you're not elderly, you don't have an underlying medical condition, those folks won't be getting it, he said, till the end of April. And that will take April, May, June, July, that will take months. So we're not getting, I want everyone to sort of have a real picture here. We're not going to have a vaccine and snap your fingers. This is under control and life goes back to normal. That is not the case at all. Now, we've hopefully gotten over one hurdle, which is that this is a very effective vaccine. So you don't need as many people to get it, to get this under control, because it is or appears to be so effective in this early data. But still, it is going to take a long time to vaccinate all the people who need to be vaccinated.
It is incredible. But what else did Dr. Fauci say? I noticed that you said you spoke to him last night. He's always so, he's the oracle. What else did he say about this, about what we should expect beyond what you've just told me?
So he said what he told NBC this morning, which is that he's very excited about this. I mean, I think that he, as you mentioned, has been working with Moderna on their vaccine, less so with Pfizer, and to see results of over 90%. He did say something interesting. I mentioned that mRNA is this new technology. And he said, Elizabeth, there have been a lot of skeptics out there, like, really, we're going to put out a vaccine to, try to get rid of or help get rid of this pandemic. And we're trusting that to new technology that's never been on the market before. And he said, hopefully this addresses those skeptics, because these two trials, so two completely independent trials by two completely different companies, got these incredible over 90% effectiveness rates.
And one last question, because, I noted what you said, that maybe not so many people would have to take it if it's that effective. But obviously the vaccine hesitant or the anti-vaxxers, I mean, the skeptics who have basically told everybody that, the pollsters, that they don't want to take it. How much of a heavy lift is that going to be, do you think?
With these polls, as you said, have shown that many people don't want to get the COVID vaccine. In the United States, even as many as 50% of people in the U.S. have said, I don't want to get this. Part of it was sort of the unfortunate name of Operation Warp Speed. That's the effort to develop and to distribute a vaccine. And Operation Warp Speed, I think when the Trump administration gave that name, they thought it was brilliant, right? Hey, we're going to make this happen quick. Well, Americans and people around the world, they don't want quick when you're trying to shoot something into their arm. They want to make sure that it's safe. So that name for sure did not help, nor did it help that President Trump kept saying we'll have a vaccine before Election Day, which of course didn't happen. The thinking is that as hesitant as people are now, hopefully once they see people start to get vaccines, they'll see their grandmother get vaccinated, their doctor will get vaccinated, a policeman will get vaccinated, firefighters. Hopefully once they see that, they'll think, oh, okay, well, they seem to have done pretty well. So hopefully this hesitancy will be converted to enthusiasm if indeed this all goes well.
Elizabeth Cohen, thank you very much indeed for that. And as we say goodbye to you and move on to our Walter Isaacson, I just want to show this picture of Elvis Presley. When you talk about people learning about it, seeing about it, he, way back when, decades ago, publicly was vaccinated with the polio vaccination, all those years ago. And that went quite a long way to persuading other people that it was okay. Now, behind every vaccine, there is also a volunteer. And you will know this one because he's our own Walter Isaacson, master biographer of great minds in science and history as well, and more used to interviewing than being interviewed. But he's joining me now from New York to share the rare experience of being a guinea pig for the Pfizer trials. Walter, welcome to your program. Tell me, what made you do this?
I'm writing a book that comes out in March on Jennifer Doudna and the people who created this gene editing technology called CRISPR, and it's based on RNA. So RNA became kind of my favorite molecule, and when I heard that Pfizer, along with Moderna, were creating vaccines that are very similar to how CRISPR developed, which is a system bacteria use to fight viruses, I said, hey, I'm going to learn to do by doing. I'm going to sign up. I was in New Orleans, my hometown. Pretty easy. You go online, sign up. The next day they called me. And it's a way to get involved in science. It's a way, just like jury duty is, to do something. It's far less hassle, believe me, than jury duty, to do something where you can get involved.
Were you at all nervous? I mean, you just heard our conversation with Elizabeth Cohen. You know, there are people who are a little bit nervous. Were you scared at any point?
No, not at all. Nor was anybody. I mean, there are 44,000 people who have been part of this trial. It's not just, you know, it's not a small number. And there's no way that there would have been a safety thing where you could have gotten COVID from it, since it's simply a piece of RNA. Plus, every night they monitor you by cell phone if you're in the trial. And with all these people doing it, there were no cases of serious side effects. So I think I was a little bit more worried about driving down Jefferson Highway to Ochsner Hospital to get into the trial than I was worried about getting the shot in my arm.
That's really interesting because, again, oh gosh, the number of people who say they're scared of taking it when it comes out. So do you know whether you got the actual, you know, vaccine, or did you get the placebo?
I don't know. I mean, you could try to find out by antibody test, but I want to play it by the rules, do what you're supposed to be doing. So they made me look away. There were two doctors in the room, and one of them said to me, she looked at me and said, look me in the eyes, and I was doing it. She had very blue eyes, like her hospital mask. And when I started to turn away and look at the needle, she said, no, look at me. I said, well, would I be able to tell just by looking at the syringe? She said, no, probably not, but we're very strict so that you don't know. Now, they did promise us that once something is authorized, they'll unblind us. Otherwise, you know, we'd just drop out of the trial if they refused to unblind us, and people wouldn't do trials anymore. So you get this assurance that if there's an authorization for this vaccine, they'll tell you whether you got the placebo or not, and you'll be not first in line, but you'll be there ready to get the real vaccine when it happens. And I think that makes people confident. Yeah, let's join these trials. I'm not going to be a pure guinea pig. And also, it helps the trial work well, because if they didn't unblind us, we'd all just quit the trial and take another vaccine, as opposed to staying in the trial and continuing to give them data.
Now, look, you're not just an ordinary citizen. You've done so much study and research into science, your books, your biographies. You've just mentioned the book you're writing about, the founder of CRISPR. What do you feel about the history of vaccine hesitancy and the spike, I suppose, these days?
You know, throughout our history, we've had citizen involvement in science. And, you know, when you talk about the polio vaccine, you know, I'm old enough to remember the March of Dimes, where we all chipped in to make sure everybody could get that vaccine, and where people like Elvis made sure they showed themselves getting the vaccine. And boy, down in New Orleans, there was no question that you were going to get that vaccine, because you couldn't go to swimming pools or anything without fear. I think it's also something important now, which is that people are a little bit intimidated by science. And in some ways, our society has become a bit, not just intimidated, but sometimes anti-science. So it's important for all of us to feel connected to things, like we try to understand maybe our computer so we can be connected to the digital revolution. we should find ways we can connect to this biotech revolution. And by being part of a clinical trial, which is totally safe and doesn't take up much time, you engage with science in a way that both reassures you, but you feel a little bit less alienated from the science. And I think that's one of the great problems of modern times, is it's not just the citizens' fault that they're skeptical of science, but in some ways, science hasn't been open enough to let people participate in the science. And the coolest, easiest way to participate as a citizen in science is just go online, not just for the coronavirus vaccine, but there's, you know, once I signed up, they were offering me dozens of clinical trials I could be part of. Sign up for a clinical trial. It's really good. And sign up with your family.
Well, that's good advice. And actually, on this program, we reported on a lot of youngsters here in Britain who wanted to do that and do their bit as well. But let me ask you about the mRNA aspect to all of this. I talked a little bit about it with Elizabeth. What is the big breakthrough historically, as far as you're concerned, with this type of vaccine?
Here is what is huge. It's just a piece of genetic code. And in the future, kids who know how to play with genetic code are going to supplant those who play with digital code. Why? Because with these RNA vaccines, it fights this COVID-19. But let's suppose another virus comes along, and it will in the next year or two or 3 years. There's another coronavirus or any type of virus that comes along. This can be easily reprogrammed. All you have to do is get the genetic sequence of the new virus, and a college biology student in a lab in one day can do the reprogramming of this sequence, so you get a new vaccine to fight any new virus that comes along. And that's what we need in this. You know, we feel like we're in the Middle Ages with wave after wave of recurring virus attacks, you know, MERS and SARS and now COVID. Here with RNA exams, you won't have to spend a lot of time. And you can, by the way, reprogram these RNA type vaccines to do other things, even detect cancer. That's what CRISPR is all about, which is a subject of my book, The Code Breakers, coming out in March, which is it can do things like edit our genes, it can fight cancer, and now we know it can fight viruses and be reprogrammed to fight each new wave of virus.
Tell me more about Jennifer Doudna. Obviously, she won the Nobel Prize with her colleague for chemistry because of this CRISPR technology. What more are you finding out that we haven't known in the public domain yet?
It's a wonderful tale of Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier, her partner, who was born in Paris, figuring out how to use CRISPR, which, as I said, is simply a piece of RNA connected to a scissors, an enzyme that can cut DNA. And now they figured out how to target it. So if you have a gene, say, for sickle cell anemia, it can be edited out. The Chinese scientist a couple of years ago used it unauthorized in order to make designer babies that wouldn't be susceptible to AIDS. What happened when they did it, and then another wonderful guy named Feng Zhang, who's at the Broad Institute at Harvard, they also all figured out how you do it in human cells. And there was a big competition between the two. It was a race to figure it out. And then there's still a patent battle. But the interesting thing about the COVID pandemic is both camps, as well as other people, said, now that we know this technology, we're going to not compete with one another, but put our intellectual property in public so we can make detection kits. I mean, this is going to come along in the next few weeks, and it'll be just as interesting, which is simple CRISPR-based detection kits that will detect the coronavirus, or for that matter, any other genetic problem you may have. These will be the type of tests you can put on your kitchen counter, you know, just almost like a pregnancy test with a little strip. That too will bring science into our lives, because just like the iPhone, people will be creating apps for these new CRISPR-based tests. So they won't only test for coronavirus, they might test for your gut biome and what your or for cancer. So this is a whole new age of biotechnology that CRISPR and the use of this wonderful molecule RNA You know, it's sibling DNA used to get all the publicity.
Yes, indeed.
DNA just sits in the nucleus of a cell and doesn't do anything, whereas RNA actually goes to work and takes those instructions and goes to the protein-making part of the cell. And
we're DNA, I'm going to stand up. I'm going to stand up for DNA, an important forensic tool as well. But before I let you go, I want to ask you about, you know, you've interviewed at least two of the members of the Biden task force on coronavirus. And I just want to play this heartbreaking soundbite from a nurse in an overstrapped hospital in South Dakota. Let's just play this.
Yeah, I think the hardest thing to watch is that people are still looking for something else and they want a magic answer. And they don't want to believe that COVID is real. And their last dying words are, this can't be happening. It's not real. And when they should be spending time FaceTiming their families, they're filled with anger and hatred. And it just made me really sad the other night. And I just can't believe that those are going to be their last thoughts and words.
Mm. Wow. Do you think a new administration can change the tone? Because that is tragic.
Absolutely. And I think that's the most important thing. Even with these vaccines, it would be good to have this administration figure out a way to how to get them distributed, where you go on a website and sign up for when you're going to take it and where. But the most important thing is to restore faith in facts and in science. And this goes back to what I was saying about we should all find ways to connect as citizens to science. Joe Biden did that when he ran the cancer task force, and he did it when his son, Beau, tragically succumbed to cancer. It made him understand the science better. I hope we can do that in ways that are less tragic than the clip you just showed of what Joe Biden had to go through. Whereas if we all feel connected to science, we'll make more rational decisions.
Yeah, it's really important. Walter Isaacson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, there is a recount underway in Georgia's presidential vote. The Secretary of State says, though, that no concerns about fraud have surfaced and the count could be done by Wednesday. If it confirms Joe Biden's victory, it would turn blue for the first time since 1992. But will that be the same in the Senate races? John Ossoff is the Democratic nominee in a runoff against sitting Republican Senator David Perdue. If he were to win, along with fellow Democrat Raphael Warnock in January, it would flip the Senate from Republican to Democrat. And John Ossoff is joining me now from Atlanta. Welcome to the program, Mr. Ossoff. What do you think? I mean, do you think lightning could strike twice? You know, it looks like the state will flip blue in the presidential, but what about in the Senate races?
Christiane, thank you for the opportunity to be with you. It's an honor. And it's really not a matter of lightning striking. It's a decade of work here, registering voters, organizing communities, mobilizing turnout, extraordinary turnout among Black voters in Georgia, work over this decade, much of it led by Stacey Abrams to expand the electorate here, and work that's continuing now. We are running the largest voter registration and get out the vote effort in American history in Georgia right now, because the stakes are so high, because for this incoming administration to be able to empower public health experts, resource a robust public health response, and invest in economic recovery, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will need to be able to govern and not to be mired in partisan gridlock in Washington. And that's why the Senate is so vital.
Of course, I understand that from your point of view. I just want to ask you, because you mentioned Stacey Abrams, and obviously she's getting a huge amount of gratitude and recognition from this amazing voter turnout. Are you working with her now? And I guess, you know, in experience, you've obviously studied runoffs and all the rest of it. Can people be motivated a second time to come out in the kinds of numbers that they did the first time?
Well, first of all, yes, Stacey is a close friend and she's heavily engaged and working hard to ensure that we win these two runoffs. And to your second question, this really is about momentum and energy and enthusiasm. And we haven't had a robustly contested runoff election for a federal office in Georgia in over a decade. But Joe Biden's victory here and all of the work that I just discussed has put the wind in our sails. We've hit the ground running. I just finished a 7-city, 4-day tour of the state. The enthusiasm is off the charts. It's all about continuing the work of getting out the vote and registering new voters. There are 23,000 young voters, for example, who become eligible to vote just between November 3rd and this January 5th runoff.
Okay, so that's interesting. You said there hasn't been this kind of a runoff for about a decade. Apparently, historically, runoffs in Georgia tend to favor Republicans. I think, if I'm not mistaken, you're 90,000 votes short of your challenger or the person you're challenging, the sitting Senator David Perdue. He doesn't want to debate you. He didn't in the first, you know, the first go around. What do you make of that? And do you, is there a way, I mean, you know, he doesn't have to, I guess, go to a debate. Would you prefer for there to be one?
I certainly would. And yes, this was the closest U.S. Senate race in the country. And my argument to Senator Perdue is that if he doesn't want to debate in a public forum, if he doesn't want to have a robust discussion of the issues and contrast our visions for the future of the state and this country at a moment of profound crisis, when nearly a quarter of a million Americans have died from this virus, with hundreds of thousands of lives and millions of jobs and homes and livelihoods hanging in the balance. If he doesn't want to come out and have a debate about the path forward, that's fine, but he shouldn't be seeking re-election to the U.S. Senate. I believe that public servants have a solemn obligation to engage publicly in discourse and debate. We should contrast our visions and our qualifications and our records and take that directly to the people for them to decide. He seems to lack the self-confidence to debate me in public. He seems to feel entitled to this Senate seat without having to go and discuss our contrasting visions in an open forum. I think that's wrong, and I think it's not going to serve him well in the upcoming election.
I'm going to play one of his campaign ads because it goes to what you're talking about, but it targets you specifically on issues, and we'll talk about them.
No negotiation, total Democratic control. That's their goal, their plan. Increase taxes, defund the police, pass the Green New Deal, open the borders, give voting rights to illegal immigrants, eliminate private health insurance, cut the military, make D.C. a state, and hack the Supreme Court. If they're in charge, America will never be the same.
So, I mean, that's a lot of, you know, cannon fire, so to speak. How do you, I guess, answer each one, or do you not? I mean, for instance, would you eliminate private insurance? Do you support Medicare for all?
No, I wouldn't, and I don't support single-payer health care. But more to the point, this is just paint-by-numbers, partisan invective. This is the kind of fear-mongering. This is the kind of divisive, hateful politics that the American people have just overwhelmingly rejected. Biden defeated Trump by the largest popular vote margin for a challenger for the presidency since Roosevelt defeated Hoover in 1932. And what we should be discussing is how we chart a course out of this pandemic, how we invest in economic recovery, how we ensure that families in Georgia and across the country have the basics that they need to flourish: healthcare, housing, dignified work that pays a living wage, equal justice under the law. That's the kind of campaign that I'm running. And I don't pay much mind, Christiane, to these partisan attack ads that are cooked up in boardrooms in Washington. They're the same across the entire country. They're totally out of touch with the needs and concerns of the people of my state who are looking at this rapidly accelerating pandemic and want results, want public health experts to be empowered. As you know, we have the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, here in Georgia. I'm looking forward to working with Joe Biden to ensure the CDC is resourced to lead the epidemiological response to this pandemic, to make investments in infrastructure and clean energy to jumpstart our economy, and then to pursue a broader program to ensure that every American family has great health care, to ensure that families can pursue college education without taking on debt, to expand opportunity, equal justice, civil rights, and voting rights. That's the kind of campaign that I'm running, and I don't pay much mind to this kind of fear-mongering, which I think has been decisively rejected by the American people in this election.
Do you, of all the issues and all the important ones, the economy and healthcare and the others that you are pursuing, I mean, do you see an area where you put most of your focus? I mean, given the first round of elections, you now know, I guess, what people are voting on. Where do you want to put most of your emphasis as you appeal to Georgians for their vote?
Well, in the short run, we have to be focused on how we end this crisis, restore some normalcy to daily life. Millions of American families are about to celebrate Thanksgiving without their families. And families across the country and indeed around the world are approaching this holiday season, knowing that they won't be able to spend it with loved ones in the same way to which we're accustomed because this virus is spreading out of control. So I'm focused on what we need to do to equip public health experts to implement an evidence and science-based approach to containing this pandemic, and then how we invest in economic recovery when there is so much suffering across the country. And the issues that the American people want to hear their leaders talk about and deliver on are the same issues that human beings everywhere are concerned with. And they are those basic conditions of human flourishing, which are universal: healthcare, housing, education, a living wage, equal justice. I believe that people everywhere, and I learned this from my mentor, Congressman John Lewis, and we see it every day across my state, just want the basics and deserve and need the basics out of life. The opportunity to build wealth for their families, to pursue enlightenment and education and opportunity, to live healthy lives free of the burden of massive debt. It's not that complicated, the kind of society that we need to and can build. And as we turn the page on this hate-filled and divisive Trump era, we have to pursue national healing, national reconciliation, become grounded again in what brings us together as Americans, and pursue that kind of optimistic vision for our country that can heal those wounds and give us a clear direction forward for the next 4, 10, and 20 years.
So let me ask you, because I do think it's fascinating that John Lewis was your mentor. What a great and towering figure. And I know that you interned for him, and I know that he endorsed you when you ran for Congress a couple of years ago. But to widen out the lens as you're doing right now, you know, President-elect Biden has made a lot of, you know, promises, and as you say, to try to narrow this divide and try to deal with the pandemic and the economy and bring, you know, healing to a very shattered nation. What will happen to his program if you don't win, and if Raphael Warnock doesn't win, and the Senate stays in the hands of Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has as yet shown little aptitude for bipartisanship? Could that change with a Biden who has a much more, you know, consensus-building gene in him, so to speak?
I think we know who Mitch McConnell is. And for the global audience that I know watches this show, you know, the Senate Majority Leader, the Republican leader who dedicated himself to foiling President Obama at every turn, who consistently puts party over country, he'll do the same thing to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris if he has the power to. He will obstruct their efforts to invest in economic recovery. He will obstruct their efforts to control this pandemic. We will have gridlock in Washington, and it will be much harder to bring this country together again. And those are the stakes of these runoff elections. You know, the United States is turning the page on the Trump era. He's leaving, whether he knows it or not. And now we're full of hope, because we have the opportunity to define the next era in American history. And it should be one rooted in unity. It should be one rooted in the principles that Congressman Lewis taught, of the beloved community, of a recognition that we're all one people, we're all sisters and brothers. Those aren't empty words. That's the basis of community. That's the basis of a shared national and human identity upon which we build a society where everyone has access to healthcare and housing and education and a living wage and equal justice. I really believe that that is a vision that can bring this country back together. And the reason that these runoff elections in Georgia are so vital is that in order for us to heal, in order for us to emerge from this crisis healthy and strong and prosperous and united, we can't have 4 years of unmitigated partisan gridlock in Washington. And that's what I'm fighting for here in Georgia, is to solve these problems, to deliver a public health response, to deliver economic recovery, so we can get out of this mess, come back together as a people, and build a stronger and more prosperous and united country.
You know, you say that, and I wonder, and this is just an observation, you know, so clearly, you know, people voted for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris on the presidential ticket. And I wonder if they, you know, voted so much Republican on the down ballots precisely to have more gridlock or whatever it is, that, you know, sort of a balance. You know, we said that we reached out to David Perdue to ask him these questions as well. He didn't respond. He didn't want to come on our program. So I'm going to play a little bit of what your fellow Democratic candidate, Raphael Warnock, has said about accusations that they just want to, you all want to turn, you know, turn the Senate over into special interest territory. Let's just play this.
I'll tell you what's on the ballot. Health care is on the ballot. Access to affordable health care. We've got 500,000 Georgians in the Medicaid gap. We've got 1.8 million Georgians with pre-existing conditions. And if Kelly Loeffler has her way, people who have asthma, people who have hypertension, diabetes, these are folks in my family and in my church, folks who are survivors of cancer, may find themselves without health care. And that's what this race is about.
So very, very quickly, John Ossoff, you seem to be on the same page as on this issue.
Yes, and the reason that American politicians like my opponent David Perdue persist in, for example, trying to deny people with pre-existing conditions like asthma and heart disease and hypertension access to health care is because of the underlying corruption in our political system, the Citizens United decision, which allows unlimited secret corporate spending on politics. That's why insurance and pharmaceutical companies and major polluting industries write the rules in Washington. And if we don't reform that campaign finance system, will be unable to deliver on ensuring that everyone has great health care, on the kind of environmental protection and investment in clean energy we need to control this climate crisis, and a whole range of other measures necessary to uphold and defend the public interest.
So much at stake. John Ossoff, thank you very much for joining us. And as we said earlier, COVID cases in the U.S. crossed the 11 million mark over the weekend, reaching yet another grim milestone. And our next guest is in a unique position to understand the virus and its ripple effects on society. Nicholas Christakis is a physician, sociologist, and a former hospice doctor. His latest book, Apollo's Arrow, explores what it means to live amid a plague like this. Here he is speaking to our Hari Srinivasan about all of this and about what he thinks President-elect Biden must do to restore confidence in institutions.
Christiane, thanks. Nicholas Christakis, welcome back. I mean, you were the first person that I spoke to from my bedroom studio when this all started in March. At the time, we were perhaps stunned to hear a prediction of 35,000 people who might be victims of COVID-19. And here we are now, past 250,000 people in the United States that have died from this. You know, something that you say in this new book that you've written, Apollo's Arrow, that right now where we are is the end of the beginning, not the beginning of the end. Explain that.
In other words, you know, we've had the first wave has struck us. The pathogen entered the human species in November and is spreading and spreading and doing what it does. Probably 12% of Americans have been infected so far. And in the end, probably 40 to 50% of Americans will be infected. And so we're just experiencing this event, this pandemic still. And as people know, we're now at the beginning of the second wave, which is going to strike, unfortunately, with tremendous force. So, and there'll be more waves, incidentally. There'll be a third wave in a year, and a vaccine will probably have been invented by then and will reduce the amplitude of that wave. But this virus is going to be with us forever.
So do the math for us. We're at a rate of roughly 140,000 infections a day. And if we have a 1% infection fatality rate, that means about 1,400 people that were, well, diagnosed or found out yesterday are likely not to survive this. So how bad does this get if we're just in the second wave and there are more waves that will inevitably come?
We have, as you said, about 250,000 Americans have died so far that we know of. But there's this old technique called the excess mortality rate, which was invented in the middle of the 19th century, which looks at the total excess deaths of people during a time of pandemic compared to normal times. And by that metric, we have more deaths, maybe 300,000 more Americans have died in the last few months than would have died in previous years. So The total burden of mortality is higher than 250,000. Probably closer to 300,000 people have died because of COVID. And as we said, about 1,000 or more per day are dying now at the sort of up ramp of the second wave. So I think it's pretty clear that at least 500,000 Americans will die before the end of this pandemic. Now, to be clear, that will take another couple of years, and maybe as many as 1,000,000. So that range of 500,000 to 1,000,000 is probably where, when the histories are written in 5 or 10 or 20 years, we will have wound up, unfortunately. I should also say, while it's completely appropriate that we focus on mortality, I also have to mention that many millions of Americans will also be disabled by this condition.
We've had conversations on this program about people who are living with COVID for a very long time, months at a time. And so what percentage of the population, setting aside for a moment, if it's 500,000 to 1,000,000 people that might be felled by this, what percentage of the population are likely to be having long-term consequences, and what's the ripple effect for us as a society, as a healthcare system?
So there's a distinction between people who have so-called long COVID, whose symptoms endure for a long time and take a long time to recover. They might have some mental problems, you know, so-called COVID fog. They might have ongoing respiratory problems and so on, but they might eventually completely recover. There's a difference between that category of people and the category of people for whom, whether the disease was short or long in duration, have some persistent disability. For example, a problem with their kidneys, renal insufficiency, or some cardiac problems, or some neurologic problems, or some persistent pulmonary fibrosis, for example. We don't know exactly what percentage that will be. It's very difficult to know this, but many experts think it might be about 5%. So we might lose, let's say, 500,000 at least Americans will die of this, but we might then have 2.5 million who have some long-term disability. And some of my colleagues, former colleagues at Harvard, Larry Summers, a former Treasury Secretary, who's an economist, and David Cutler, who's a health economist there, recently published a paper that called this the $16 trillion virus. $8 trillion due to economic impact on our society, and another $8 trillion due to the health impact, death, disability, and illness. These are vast sums. This is an enormous calamity that has befallen us. And I'm not here to doomsay. I'm just here to try as much as possible to frame for listeners the reality of what we're facing, because I think that the sooner we accept this reality and the sooner the American people rise to this occasion with a sense of civic purpose and a sense of maturity and abandon a sense of wishful thinking, the better able we will be to band together to cope with and repel this virus that's threatening us.
Getting from the global down to the personal, in the book you talk about your former life, if you will, as a hospice doctor, and you talk about how you have literally held the hands of so many people that have passed on at that moment when they were alone. That is probably one of the most heartbreaking effects of COVID, is to hear these stories and read these stories about loved ones who were separated at that last second. What can we do as a society now, 9 months in, 10 months in, knowing what we know, to at the very least give people that moment of dignity or peace?
Well, one of the things that's so upsetting about plagues is that they are grief-making. They're a time of grief and a time of loss. People lose their lives, they lose their livelihoods, they lose their way of life, and many Americans are seeing this. Schools are closing, people are losing their jobs, we can't go to dinner with our friends anymore, we can't go out to restaurants. It's sad. I mean, this has happened, you know, in medieval times or in ancient Greece. People talk about the same exact phenomena that we are discussing. And similarly, one of the phenomena that they talk about is people dying alone. Because during a time of a contagious disease, at least in the past, people were afraid that they would contract the disease by caring for the decedent. And in fact, during the bubonic plague, you literally got it from dead bodies. As people were dying, the fleas that had transmitted the bubonic plague would leap from the person who had just died. The fleas could sense that the body was cold. They have an ability to sense warmth. And they would leap to the nearest warm body, which was the people caring for the person who had died, you know, cleaning their body and so on. So We have centuries of descriptions of dying alone in times of plague. And it shocked me as a hospice doctor in 2020 in modern America where that this had returned. Now, it returned for a number of very specific reasons, which we can, as a rich society and as a scientifically grounded society, address. Believe it or not, one of the main reasons it returned was that we didn't have enough PPE. In other words, we couldn't spare the PPE for family members to come to the hospital to be with their person, friend, loved one dying of COVID, which is an appalling, I mean, just an appalling dereliction of on the part of our leaders that we weren't equipped to deal with this. To my eye, someone who's dying, their loved ones should be there. That's a priority for them and for their loved ones. And I believe despite the burdens on our healthcare system, our system should be organized to meet that important human need.
You trace throughout this book how going backwards through time, there are almost these three distinct phases to pandemics like the one that we're in now. But break those down for us.
Okay, so what's happening now is we are in the biological and epidemiological phase of the pandemic. The virus was set loose in our species and we had no natural immunity to speak of, or very limited natural immunity. We are very likely to invent a vaccine in the coming months, which is fantastic news. This is great news. Probably many vaccines will be invented. But once we invent a vaccine, we still have to manufacture it, distribute it, and persuade people to take it. And that's going to take time, perhaps a year. So from where I sit, 2022 is a landmark year, which I call the immediate pandemic period, by which time we will have reached herd immunity either naturally or through vaccination. And what that means is from now until then, we're going to be living in a changed world, wearing masks, physical distancing, intermittent school closures, intermittent lockdowns, just as we're seeing right now. But then in 2022, we'll cross into what I consider to be the intermediate period. So the epidemiological and biological shock will be behind us, but we're still going to have to deal with the psychological, social, and economic sequelae of the virus. And that, judging from historical pandemics, will take a couple of years till our economy gets stood up again, people feel normal about going to airports and restaurants and so forth again, begin to take their masks off and so on. And then in 2024, we'll reach what I consider to be the post-pandemic period, approximately. These are approximate figures. And that could be like the roaring 20s after 1918. So all the increased religiosity, you know, religion rises during times of plagues, the abstemiousness, the saving, you know, people are saving money now, people are avoiding risk, all of that will reverse. And so people, I think, at beginning around 2024 will relentlessly seek out social interactions. They'll go to nightclubs and restaurants and sporting events and political rallies. People will start spending liberally again. There'll be a lot of risk-taking, joie de vivre, for example, maybe some sexual licentiousness. Some people have read these descriptions and said, you know, here's hoping, you know, that's the world we live in. But the point is, there will be some kind of efflorescence, some kind of effervescence, I think, that begins around 2024.
Right now, there is a very strong contingent of people who say, we cannot afford to continue down this path between now and 2024. The poverty that we are inflicting on our people by having this crushed economy is possibly worse than what the virus could do to us.
Well, just remember, only part of what's happening to us is because we're doing it to ourselves. The virus is the real enemy. The virus is doing this to us. The virus slows down economies. You know, we have descriptions from the plague of Justinian 1500 years ago that talk about how everything slows and ceases. The world became still. This was before, you know, there were governments ordering people to stay homes or closing schools. This is what virus, you know, pandemics do, what epidemics do. This is awful, but I don't think willful denial helps us, right? And you know, let's remember that plague is one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And if that's the case, you can think of lies and denial as being the squire of the horsemen, you know, following right behind. So just as germs spread through social networks, since time immemorial, lies and denial have spread right behind it. And this is where I think leadership is so important, and where I fault the Trump administration, which I think has fostered a culture of superstition, denial, even lies about the epidemic, pretending that it's not a big deal, pretending that hydroxychloroquine will be a miracle drug when this was known to be false, and on and on. And where I hope that President-elect Biden will more capably lead us, because we need our leaders to be square with us in times of plague, because it's so tempting to lie and deny.
How does a President-elect Biden renew faith in institutions? I mean, this past year and a half has shaken the confidence of millions of people in things like the CDC and the FDA, things that we thought were bedrock reliable. People are now saying, well, I don't know if I should take this vaccine that's been approved by the FDA. Maybe I should wait for a million other people to be my guinea pigs.
Yes, that's a serious concern. Now, it is true the CDC stumbled early on with a test, and that there was a complicated bureaucratic interactions with the FDA, which sort of boring to go into, but we could have done better with the tests. But generally speaking, the CDC scientists know exactly what's going on. So to restore confidence, I think we're going to need a number of communication strategies. And I should say, as a nation, we need to work together to tamp down on falsehood and to begin to hold our leaders to account for honesty and accuracy. So how do we do that? I think it's very important when leaders communicate in times of stress that they are honest with people, share the basis for their statements. Here's my evidence for why I'm saying this, and their degree of uncertainty. That way, when you revise your opinion in a month and you say, actually, I had told you this, but now I'm changing my mind, you can explain why. You can say, I was only 50% sure back then. This was the evidence then. Now we have new evidence. So the ability to admit failure or wrongness is a very important part of maintaining credibility. And finally, willingness to break bad news and to say to people, during a time of a deadly contagion, there's no life without risk. There's no easy out. And I think here the American people need to be called to service and called to sacrifice and called to common purpose.
You've studied this. You've written about this, the idea that we fundamentally want to create good societies, that part of a good society is sacrificing for something greater than ourselves. Do you see that happening right now, especially in the U.S.?
I do, actually. I mean, during times of epidemics, there's a lot of badness that happens. There's blaming other people. There's denial and lies. There's abandonment. We've discussed some of those things. But also, there are good things. People band together to work together. People are kind to each other. Doctors and healthcare workers and first responders take personal risks. Some of them die as a result of trying to help other people. So there's a sense in which human beings are called not only by our sort of political or social desires to fight the virus, but by our innate nature to work together, actually to be kind to each other and care for each other when we're sick. So I see a lot of goodness in human beings, and I see a lot of promise in our society in more effectively working together to invent technologies to fight the virus and to band together to implement the kinds of procedures we need for some time to survive this modern plague.
So why do you think there's a portion of Americans who don't agree with the idea of sacrificing for the greater good when it comes to doing something like wearing a mask? Well, why is that a reality in this country versus how other countries have dealt with this in a very collective fashion?
Well, some countries, yes, have done better than others, but the desire to deny the reality of plague is ever present. And again, I think this is where the role of leadership comes in. That the fact that human beings don't wish to accept it. In some ways, you could even make the argument that it's the perfection of our democracy that allows us to have the leaders we deserve. So if people want to be lied to, they will vote for leaders who will lie to them. And in a society in which the will of the people is reflected effectively, then you get the leaders you deserve. But those aren't good leaders, actually. We can criticize those leaders and say, you know, they are not being truthful. Their duty is to be honest. So I think everyone needs to rise to the occasion. The American people need to rise to the occasion. The leaders need to rise to the occasion. Other officials need to rise to the occasion. And if you compare us to other countries, yes, some countries have done as poorly as us, but I don't see the fact that other countries have done just as bad as us as an excuse. I see us as the United States of America. We have the CDC. We're a rich nation. We are we are supposedly able to deal with these things. And so I held us to a higher standard, and I think we could have done better, and I hope we will do better.
The book is called Apollo's Arrow. Nicholas Christakis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Hari.
And finally tonight, a comment on my program at the end of last week. I observed the 82nd anniversary of Kristallnacht, as I often do. It is the event that began the horrors of the Holocaust. I also noted President Trump's attacks on history, facts, knowledge, and truth. I shouldn't have juxtaposed the two thoughts. Hitler and his evil stand alone, of course, in history. I regret any pain my statement may have caused. My point was to say how democracy can potentially slip away and how we must always zealously guard our democratic values. And that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.